So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Great to see you all here, a small but intrepid band. Welcome to our yearly Rohatsu retreat. Traditionally, the Rohatsu Sesshin is a week-long retreat held at this time of year and ending typically December 8th. It's the most rigorous of the year in a Zen monastery, and it's held in both commemoration of and a kind of ceremonial reenactment of Shakyamuni Buddha's sitting down beneath the Bodhi tree and vowing not to arise until he had achieved enlightenment, until he had broken free of the fetters of self-clinging and delusion. But here at Mountain Rain, we actually have our biggest sesshin in November at Loon Lake. So this is a little bit anticlimactic, and yet it's still a really important marker of the year in Zen communities, Rohatsu. And so we've over the years tried out different ways of doing it. But last year, for the first time, we actually some of us sat through the whole night. That's monks are urged the final night of Rohatsu Sesshin to sit through the last night. And it was wonderful. I didn't even think that I would do it, but got to be midnight and I couldn't leave. It was really lovely. Some of us might do that again this year, and those of us who do will be doing it for all of you, for those who aren't, just like all of you here are sitting here for those who can't be here. So one way or another, together, we'll sit Rohatsu Sesshin. It's sort of like this is the second installment. Loon Lake was the first part, and now we're doing the last day and night and morning of a full Rohatsu Sesshin. But we haven't come from already sitting for 6 days or 5 days. We've come from our busy lives and carrying the residues of that, of our work and family lives and emotional lives with us. And we're not in a remote mountain monastery. We're here in a storefront on Wall Street. But we can sit together this weekend with the knowledge that we are doing this ancient practice taught by the Buddha, along with people all over the world. People are sitting Rohatsu Sesshin this week. And knowing that, we'll renew our own determination and take courage from our Dharma ancestors and from each other. Sesshin means to touch the heart-mind. It's often translated gather the mind. And I don't know who first did that, but it kind of bugs me because the actual meaning of Setsu or Sesshin, the first character, is to touch, which I think is quite beautiful, you know, to touch our own heart and mind. And Shin in Chinese and Japanese, the character is actually a pictogram of the four-chambered heart. And it means heart and mind, which aren't separate. So to touch our heart and mind and body, to be fully present with our experience moment to moment, just as it is in each moment. And our conventional way of speaking, to say my experience or our experience, probably I just should say experience, to be more accurate, because as soon as we say our or my, we already distort the reality that my experience, what we call my experience, is not mine. It's completely interconnected with all other phenomena unfolding without limit through time and space. So if we sit sesshin to accomplish or get something for ourselves, like to get enlightened, we're actually already deluded. We sit sesshin with and for all other beings, whether we even realize it or not. Because that's the nature of reality. Often at Rohatsu, we tell the traditional story of Shakyamuni's long and valiant vigil under the Bodhi tree, facing the armies of Mara, the tempter. It's a tale in the heroic mode. But this year we thought we'd take a little bit of a different approach with some guidance from Dogen Zenji, founder of our school of Zen in Japan, and Keizan Zenji, his successor, who Michael will introduce tomorrow. We might think, as we sit down to sesshin, that we're doing this, as I said, in order to get enlightened, become enlightened, like the Buddha. But that would be a misrepresentation of what Dogen calls great enlightenment. Enlightenment that goes beyond delusion and enlightenment, beyond samsara and nirvana. Dogen tells us over and over again in his writing that enlightenment is not something we achieve. It's what we actualize in each moment of our practice. It's a reality that we actualize in the living, in the breathing, in the sitting, in the walking. Dogen says, if you speak of achieving enlightenment, you may think that you usually don't have enlightenment. If you say enlightenment comes, you may wonder where it comes from. If you say, I have become enlightened, you may suppose that enlightenment has a beginning. There's a famous Zen story about this, a koan. It's probably familiar to some of you. Zen master Nanyue came to visit Mazu, his student, but who was already quite experienced. So they were really more like colleagues, old Dharma friends when this happened. Mazu got up to greet him. Nanyue said, what have you been doing lately? Mazu said, I've been just sitting. Nanyue said, what is your intention in just sitting? Nanyue answered, I intend to become a Buddha. Then Nanyue picked up an old roof tile that was lying on the ground, and he started to polish it with a stone. And Mazu said, what are you doing? Polishing a tile. Why are you polishing that tile? I'm trying to make a mirror. How can you make a mirror by polishing a tile? And Nanyue said, how can you become a Buddha by doing zazen? So Dogen, after telling this story, says people have been interpreting this great story for hundreds of years. So that story was already old when Dogen first encountered it. The story probably goes back to maybe the 9th century in China. And Dogen lived in the 13th century in Japan. And we live in the 21st century here in Canada. And we're still telling this old story. This koan is typically understood to express the Mahayana Buddhist understanding that we don't practice zazen to become a Buddha in some far distant future, but to actualize our inherent Buddha nature in each moment of full awareness. But this story could also be construed as saying zazen's not really necessary. If we're Buddhas already, why do we need to practice? This was a core question for Dogen as a young man. He had ordained before Zen had even come to Japan. He ordained when he was about 14 into the Tendai tradition. And the Tendai sect really emphasized this concept of original enlightenment, that we all have Buddha nature inherently. But it offered a kind of smorgasbord of practices. They did all kinds of different practices. Many of which were esoteric Buddhist practice, tantric Buddhist practices. We think of Vajrayana Buddhism, we associate it with Tibetan Buddhism. But there were two major schools of Vajrayana Buddhism very, very strong in Japan before Zen ever arrived. And one of them was this Tendai and the other was Shingon sect. But Dogen came to feel there was something missing for him because he observed not enough sitting and also a kind of slackness in the practice of the precepts. This sect was very wealthy, and they even had warrior monks who would go and harass other temples. And not only that, they would, you know, drink and carouse. And you know, Dogen, as a young man, had that kind of zeal that he's looking at some of these questionable aspects of the practice where he was, and so he left and entered one of the very first Rinzai temples to be established in Japan, and then with his teacher there went to China, where he encountered his teacher, his Rinzai teacher died there in China, and then Dogen met Rujing, who taught him the Caodong, or Soto in Japanese, practice that he brought back and established in Japan. And this approach emphasized wholehearted, lifelong practice, permeating every aspect of our lives. And this practice as the way to express and actualize our inherent, our boundless Buddha nature. And this is what Dogen wrote about so beautifully in his collected writings, his collected longer writings, titled Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And in one of the sections that are called fascicles of this big masterwork, which is called The Point of Zazen, Dogen counters two misconceptions about Zazen. First, he presents a koan. A monk asked, and this is a famous one, I'm sure this will be familiar to some of you. A monk asked Master Yaoshan, "In steadfast sitting, what do you think?" Yaoshan replied, "Think not thinking." Or sometimes it's translated non-thinking. The monk said, "How do you think not thinking?" "Beyond thinking," said Yaoshan. So this is, Dogen is often quoted as actually saying this, but he's quoting the older source. Dogen uses that phrase, "think not thinking." How do you think not thinking, beyond thinking? In Fukan Zazengi, which we chant sometimes in our chanting service. Dogen wants to counter the idea we have that Zazen is a matter of achieving a blank, empty mind. We think that's what we should accomplish in our Zazen. To think not thinking is to go beyond thinking, to allow mental content to arise and pass without grabbing onto it, without pushing it away, to not be attached even to having a serene, empty mind. so that sometimes our mind will become very still and serene, and sometimes it will be more active, and sometimes it'll be in turmoil. But we sit upright with integrity, fully present with whatever state arises. So here's one of the misconceptions that Dogen wants to address. He says, careless students in recent times say, the endeavor of Zazen is completed when your heart is quiescent, as Zazen is a place of calmness. So he's saying this is a misconception. He insists it's much more than that. If we get all excited and think we're enlightened for good, if we have one experience of deep stillness and dropping away of our sense of self, we're apt to be deeply disappointed when our delusions surge up again, or when we're not able to sustain our serenity when we go back to our daily life. Experiences of deep opening do happen. Sometimes profound soul-shaking experiences, sometimes gentle, heart-opening experiences. We do have these experiences. They do happen. Often when we're not trying to get them, so often they surprise us, you know. Sometimes, more often than not, they're not even in Zazen, these experiences. There are lots of stories in the literature of these kind of sudden experiences that take the person by surprise almost when they've given up or let go of trying so hard. Something will happen. A stone will hit a bamboo trunk, and something will shift, something will open. There's a beautiful story of a very early woman, nun, in India, who led a very, very hard life, extreme losses, lost her husband, her children, lost her mind as a result of Patachara is her name, in case you are wondering, and came to met the Buddha in this state of utter despair and collapse, and practiced for years, and tried to be released from her suffering. And the story goes that at the end of a long night, she went to I think cut the wick of her lamp, and it turned. Her mind and heart opened, and self-clinging dropped away. So it's not that those experiences don't happen, but that we can't. They're ungraspable. The next moment comes, and the rest of our life unfolds. And we live in a world of great suffering. So we integrate. I think that's why I like the word integrity, you know, sitting with integrity, because we're always integrating everything into our practice. So Dogen points out another misconception. There are also people, he says, who say, practicing Zazen is essential for those who are beginners or those who have started studying recently, but it's not necessarily the activity of Buddha ancestors, meaning, you know, the old guard. Activity in daily life is Zen, and sitting is Zen. In speaking and in silence, in motion and stillness, your body should be tranquil. Do not be concerned only with the practice of Zazen. Well, I'm actually very much in sympathy with the view that our practice extends throughout our daily life activities, in speaking, in silence, in motion, and stillness. But I don't think Dogen's denying that that's the case. He's saying, don't use that to rationalize giving up Zazen. To say, after you've been practicing a year or two, because, oh well, everything is Zazen. So I don't really need to sit anymore, because I kind of get it. He goes on to say, who are beginners? Are there any who are not beginners? When do you leave the beginner's mind? Know that in the definitive study of the Buddha Dharma, you engage in zazen and endeavor in the way. At the heart of the teaching is a practicing Buddha who does not seek to become a Buddha. At the heart of the teaching is a practicing Buddha who does not seek to become a Buddha. As a practicing Buddha does not become a Buddha, the fundamental point is realized. The embodiment of a Buddha is not becoming a Buddha. So he's making a little fine, this might seem like a fine point, but it's an important point that he's making, is that our Buddha nature is only actualized in the living of it, in the practicing of it. So there are sudden and gradual awakening. We've heard these terms, and they're often used in a way that creates kind of false dichotomy, I think. Awakening is always sudden. Each breath is sudden. Each breath comes and goes and will never be that same breath again. So awakening is always sudden, and it's also always gradual. We must continue integrating and deepening our practice, ripening and maturing our practice. So Dogen's saying when we sit in zazen, we embody Buddha nature. We don't turn from one thing into another, from a deluded human being into a Buddha. Scholar and Zen teacher Taigen Dan Leighton has written an interesting article called Zazen as Enactment Ritual, in which he makes the case that the formal practice of zazen is a kind of ritual enactment of the Buddha's awakening. We literally embody the Buddha's awakening moment to moment as we pay attention, breath to breath. He sees the influence of the Vajrayana tradition in the tantric practices of identifying with a specific Buddha or Bodhisattva, those visualization practices that the Tibetan Buddhists do. He says their zazen is in some way akin to that, just in taking that noble posture and doing that practice, that simple practice of attending to body and mind. But don't be thrown off by his use of the word ritual. Here's what he says. This ritual zazen expressing realization is not a pointless or dull routinized activity, inertly enshrining some prior experience. Dogen says, what is called zazen is to sit, cutting through the smoke and clouds without seeking merit, just becoming unified, never reaching the end. Already such, how can we penetrate it? Behind these zazen instructions and encouragements to actively enact awareness in practice is a strong attitude of persistent inquiry that permeates Dogen's teachings and his challenges to his disciples. Dogen's zazen can even be seen as a ritualized mode of silent inquiry, and this attitude of inquiry is reinforced in many of his talks about zazen. So it's a very active and dynamic practice, really, of inquiring into the nature of body and mind. It's not just, oh well, we'll just sit here and whatever. In this view, Dogen's practice of zazen is at the core of the inquiry that he calls the Genjo Koan. That's the title of one of his writings, which means the fundamental koan, the fundamental question of our existence, which is ultimately what all the koans are about. They're all about the same thing. So going back to Dogen's description of a practicing Buddha, he says, when you break through the snares and cages, and he means the snares and cages of our concepts, our mental habit patterns. When you break through the snares and cages, right now you have the ability to enter the realm of Buddha and enter the realms of demons throughout the ages. Going forward and going backward, you personally have the freedom of overflowing ditches, overflowing valleys. So he's using water imagery here to describe a kind of flowing heart, mind, body that can move freely in the realms of nirvana and samsara, not snagged, even by our notions about enlightenment. That's what Dogen calls great enlightenment, or sometimes going beyond Buddha. And this great enlightenment, in some strange and paradoxical way, includes our delusions in a way that allows us to see them without being in their thrall, without being caught, caged by them. And that is a great liberation. So here's another koan that Dogen uses. A monk asked Master Jingzhao, what happens when a greatly enlightened person becomes deluded? What happens when a greatly enlightened person becomes deluded? Jingzhao answers, a broken mirror no longer reflects images. Fallen flowers do not climb back up the tree. So in our conventional way of thinking, for a greatly enlightened person to become deluded is a kind of disaster, a fall from grace. We're not too happy with ourselves, are we, when after a kind of heart and mind opening experience in Sesshin, we go back to our everyday lives and throw a hissy fit at our partner or plunge into despair at a bad critique from our boss, right? We think, oh man, you know, all that practice and here I am. But Dogen's got something else to say about delusion. He says, the so-called greatly enlightened person has neither been enlightened from the beginning nor received enlightenment from somewhere else. Great enlightenment is not something one encounters when one is old after having worked for a long time as an ordinary monk in a monastery. You know, it's not something you get to way out there. It does not emerge by pulling it out from oneself. Nevertheless, one is greatly enlightened. And he says, don't regard not being deluded as great enlightenment. Huh? Don't try to become deluded in order to obtain the seeds for great enlightenment. He's playing with us here. Know that there is great enlightenment that makes becoming deluded intimate. There is great enlightenment that makes becoming deluded intimate. So there's an enlightenment that is so spacious, so all-encompassing, that our delusions can arise and we can meet them with intimacy, patience, kindness, wisdom. He says, don't regard great enlightenment as becoming a Buddha, returning to the source and manifesting a Buddha body. Do not regard becoming deluded as returning to be a sentient being. So don't just think that, oh my God, you know, there I am, deluded, what a backslider. Indeed, great enlightenment is limitless, delusion is limitless, and delusion does not hinder great enlightenment. Now there's a koan for you. This is a clue to Jingzhao's kind of cryptic answer, a broken mirror no longer reflects images. Fallen flowers do not climb back up the tree. A mirror breaking is the symbol for the ego self dropping away. You know, the mirror that we're always looking at ourselves, right? So the broken mirror is when that drops away. And flowers falling symbolize the impermanence of the phenomenal world around us. In one moment, we may be open, And the next, we may be closed. Just this moment. This moment. This moment. Another famous Dogen quote comes to mind related to this. The Buddha way, and this is from the Genjo Koan, the Buddha way, in essence, is leaping clear of abundance and lack. Leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus, there is birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. All these things that we tend to see as in opposition are simultaneous. Yet, he says, in attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. He's saying, what we are most attached to, we will eventually have to part with. In attachment, blossoms fall. You know, cherry blossoms are the symbol in Japan, in Japanese culture, of the ephemeral beauty of life. In attachment, no matter how attached we are, the flowers will fall. And no matter how much we detest them, the weeds will spring up. So how can we practice with a mind of great enlightenment, spacious enough to leap clear of abundance and lack? Well, Dogen gives us some guidance. He tells us how to sit with the mind states that arise and cloud our view. In the Buddha's story, those states are called Mara, the tempter. When Buddha sits through the long night, Mara appears as desire, fear, doubt, envy, resentment. Each of us could make up a list of our most common Mara states. Mara tempts us to stay in our familiar kind of self-focused world. We usually think of temptation as, temptations to, we associate temptation with desire, right? But temptation can also be temptation to fall into resentment or anger or fear, you know, habit patterns. That's temptation too. And the temptation is because we cling to what's familiar. You know, we cling to what we know. Even though we long to be free, we still cling to our suffering. The Tibetan Buddhists call it nostalgia for samsara. Great phrase. In Zen language, the objects of our senses, you know, that we either grab or push away, the objects of our senses, and also of our mind, because our mind, our consciousness is also considered a sense in Buddhist thought. All those objects are called specks of dust, specks of dust, and the our world is often called the dusty world, right? But it's right from within this matrix of our dusty world that realization arises. Dogen says, realization is reality right now. Even shocks, doubts, fears, and frights are none other than reality right now. However, with Buddha knowledge, it is different. Seeing a speck of dust is different from sitting within a speck of dust. He's talking here about the way that when we shine the light of awareness moment to moment on our experience, it's different from being caught up in that experience. So seeing a speck of dust, seeing fear arise, held in this Buddha knowledge, with Buddha knowledge, seen with our Dharma eye, is different from being caught, completely ensnared in that fear or that desire. Zen texts, or even Buddhist texts in general, don't really talk much more about desire than about fear. Even though fear, I think, is such a dominant state for many of us, perhaps under-acknowledged. But here is Dogen saying that our very doubts, our very fears and shocks, the most painful experiences in our lives, when we can hold them or see them with compassionate awareness, we see that they are impermanent, conditional phenomena. And when we do that, these very specks of dust are what wake us up. Dogen says, even when you sit in the world of phenomena, it is not broad. Even when you sit in a speck of dust, it is not narrow. If you are not fully present, you do not fully sit. If you are fully present, you are free of how large or narrow it is where you are. So that kind of evaluation, this is too small, this is too big, this is kind of, you know, the way we're always kind of gauging, measuring our experience. When we're fully present, we don't have to do that. He says, is that the manifestation? Oh, sorry. Is it that the manifestation of your practice now originates in the world of phenomena or in a speck of dust? Just this turning of Dharma blossoms is the original practice, deep and wide. Turning of Dharma blossoms is that kind of way that our mind, our heart and mind, our view, open like a flower. That's the turn, and turn. That turning from suffering into opening. He calls that the turning of Dharma blossoms, or the opening of Dharma blossoms. In seeing the speck of dust and seeing the world of phenomena, there is no attempt to create or measure. So we're not having to manipulate our experience to make it more satisfactory. The way the Buddha met Mara in the old stories was to say, I see you, Mara, I see you. And Mara would melt away or kind of skulk away, embarrassed. This happened not just during the long night of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree or nights, but throughout the Buddha's life. I was really moved to discover that Mara continued to appear to the Buddha periodically. I found it quite comforting that to realize the Buddha, even after his profound enlightenment experience, was a human living in a human world. And he met challenges as he taught and traveled. His own cousin tried to murder him. There was dissension in the Sangha. There were wars and a lot of human suffering. So Mara would, you know, appear. And the Buddha would face his own maybe doubts and fears. And he'd say, yes, Mara, my old friend, I see you. More and more, even as you read these stories, towards the end of his life, it was more like Mara was his old friend. Just a little reality check. Oh, yeah, thanks, Mara. I see you. Now, you may have wondered why I would want to tell you all about not striving to become a Buddha on the very day and night that we're going to sit in commemoration of Shakyamuni Buddha's legendary marathon of sitting under the Bodhi tree, determined not to get up until he broke through and awakened. Why would I want to subvert that story? Well, maybe now you have a bit of an idea. First, because Dogen did, and so did the Chinese ancestors before him. And I don't think they were so much subverting that old story, but kind of opening up, kind of blowing it wide open, letting fresh air in, perhaps in a way that needed to be done at that time. Maybe it still needs to be done for us too. Because I feel somehow that when I sit with those old ancestors in their company, that they help me stay upright and to see the dust of my life as it is. I think we need this kind of encouragement at this time in our human history, a widely inclusive vision of this simple, elegant practice of Zazen, not just for lifelong monastics, but for teachers and parents, carpenters and farmers, bankers and lawyers, scientists and artists, ordinary folks like you and me. This version of the Buddha's enlightenment story is still a heroic story, but it's the heroism of ordinary people having the courage to sit through the night as the Buddha did and face their demons of craving, fear, and doubt. To see a speck of dust without sitting in the speck of dust. Saying, "I see you, Mara." And in that seeing, to be released. And it's still an epic story. Because it's not just Shakyamuni Buddha's story. It's our human story. Our quest for liberation, for a way to live in this world where there's so much suffering, with wisdom and compassion and engagement. It's an ancient story, and it's also vividly contemporary. So with the help of these our great ancestors, we can carry on. Nanyue asked Mazu, "What is your intention in just sitting?" Mazu said, "To become a Buddha." Dogen says, "Mazu meant that Zazen is inevitably the intention to become Buddha, and that Zazen is inevitably becoming Buddha with intention. Intention is prior to becoming a Buddha and after becoming a Buddha. Intention is the very moment of becoming Buddha. Intention," that's Dogen, and I will add, "intention is the vow we renew with each breath. The vow to awaken for the benefit of all beings, to see our lives with our true Dharma eye." So please, please sit in the company of all these fine companions and with the ancestors as we sit through this weekend. May our